Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. I'm your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett.
I have to tell you about an article I read.
Yes.
Years ago, back in my 20s, I was still a minister of youth at a Baptist church, and we were up in the Akron, Canton, Ohio area doing mission work for a small church there that needed help. We were painting and cleaning and just helping them out because they couldn't afford it. And in that area was the Grace Cathedral, run by evangelist Ernest Angsley. Are you familiar with him?
I am familiar with Ernest Angsley, but if there are younger people listening to this podcast, they're not going to know who the hell that man is.
Yeah, for years he was on television. I don't even know if he's on television anymore, but he was on television. He's very flamboyant, very everything stereotypical that you would think of as a televangelist. Well, one of the ladies at the church where we were working said, "Would you like to go?" They offer tours of the church. Looking back on it and talking back on it now sounds just kind of bizarre. But yes, we decided to do that. And so they took us on this tour. This lady who is a member of the church was our tour guide. And it was just us because there was a bunch of us. So she walked us around and we went into the sanctuary, and she just was so exuberant about the fact that their flower budget was, you know, $600 or $700 a week. And I was thinking, that's the budget of this little mission church we're doing in a month. But, and their pulpit, the piano and the organ inside the church are 24 karat gold plated.
Oh my God.
His Ernest's wife, who was in the ministry with him for years, Angel Angsley, was buried on site. And there's this huge, huge angel memorial there over her grave. And at the, it was just, it, you know, fear of God. And then there's a room in the church of just her stuff. Kind of like you would see in Graceland, I guess.
What year was this?
This was in the late 70s. Because I was in my 20s, maybe. Yeah, had to be 20s because I was still a youth minister. And his church was huge then. He was on television. And, you know, anyway, I had read one of his books called Raptured. And his book was designed to scare the hell out of you, to scare you into Jesus' arms, I reckon. And so anyway, we went and we visited the church. I actually had an encounter with him. We were going through something and I heard this, somebody just screaming, just railing on somebody. And me being curious, I kind of walked over to look in and I heard this man saying, "It's my damn church." And he looked up at, I mean, just screaming. He looked up at me and says, "Hello." It was Ernest Angsley. So, I mean, it was like Dr. Jekyll, nice. Mr. Hyde type of thing.
Nice.
In the restrooms, which were very gaudy and gold and everything, there were signs in the men's room over the urinal, personally written, I guess, according to the way it was written, from him, encouraging us to watch how we aimed at the urinals. Because it was signed by Pastor Angsley. So anyway, it was just this whole experience. And so I've always had this Ernest Angsley experience in my head. So I read this article this week that now some audio tapes have come out where he is admitting to sexual encounters with male staffers on his church, within his church. And then there are obviously news videos of people who are now saying that he touched them inappropriately, had them undress in front of him, touched themselves while he watched. So it's a very kind of bizarre twist. I have to say, this is going to be terrible. the fact that he was doing this did not surprise me. The fact that I read he's 97 years old, I guess I just never thought of him as aging like that, because I remember when he was in the ministry and on TV all the time. But the fact that he was doing it never surprised me, because if you were to look at just what people typically consider stereotypical behavior, he had it all. This is mannerisms are just kind of, and his affectations just kind of always made my gaydar go ding, ding, ding. So the fact that he did it didn't really surprise me. And he's, you know, old school Pentecostal, where he slaps people on the head and they're slain in the spirit and he does the whole thing, but it's all very flamboyant. And he had a huge mega church in the Akron Canton area. So very well known, very popular, but now just seeing this come out, and it's not about the actions, because we've seen this over and over and over again.
Right.
But when I read it, of course, you popped into my head. Wait a minute. Let me rephrase that.
Yeah, please do. I'll wait.
The way you, when you talk about cognitive dissonance and these kinds of things, you're, the way you always talk about it, how people are able to separate these things in their lives, it was just to me one more indication, one more example of somebody whose life is a duality. You call it a double life, but there's duality in his life where he's saying one thing, because he's always been very, very anti-gay. He's written books on it and preached sermons on it. And yet in his own private life, this stuff is going on.
Which I think is pretty typical. I have to say, he really was the quintessential televangelist of his day.
Yes.
If there was somebody you could point to and say, that's what a televangelist is, he perfectly fit that mold.
Yeah.
What was surprised me, though, was that people would follow him.
Well, I always felt the same way, even in my most conservative, fundamental period of life. And of course, I wasn't charismatic or Pentecostal. It always confounded me that anybody could take him seriously.
He's like a slimy car salesman.
Yes,
he's always been that way.
Very cartoonish to me.
Very cartoonish, and he's got the toupee to match.
The toupee. I'd never understood that, because he can afford to have a 24-karat gold-plated pulpit piano and organ, but he has the worst-looking toupee I think I've ever seen. It honestly looks like something you would see on a Saturday Night Live skit.
Talk about cognitive dissonance. He's not putting the pieces together.
No, and I know how catty I sound saying this.
It does sound catty.
But we're
headed to a point here.
I'm owning the purr here.
Yes.
There is a point, yes, because we've seen this in a previous episode that we did about Bill Gothard, who preached such a life of purity and abstinence and no sex out of marriage. Then we find out there's scores of women who are talking about being sexually assaulted by him. So there is this kind of pattern.
You know, the way I see this is that we live our lives in a way where we totally believe these things. We, you know, we believe God in a certain way. We act a certain way. But there's always that underlying piece of our lives that doesn't quite fit the narrative. And it's a lot more glaring when it's somebody like him or other pastors or other conservative politicians. I know, you know, we're kind of joking about this. It's impossible almost to talk about a fallen conservative without talking about homosexuality, because that just seems to go.
Right. And that's not even the point here.
Or that's not even the point here, right? It's just that living by these ideals that just don't work. They're not realistic. And it pushes people underground. If he's gay, he's gay.
Yeah.
Which I would like to differentiate. There's a difference between being gay and being a molester.
Correct. And I totally get the conflict that people feel. I lived it myself for so many years. This is different when you're using a position of authority,
right,
to have your way with somebody, whether it's male or female. That's sexual abuse.
No, I'm with you on this. The duality here is so glaring, and it's kind of the Catholic Church thing is we're looking at it. It's so obvious to those on the outside, and you roll your eyes and you think, not another one. But it, again, it just highlights this need that we're trying to fit lives that don't fit into an ideology. Mm-hmm. The ideology doesn't work.
Well, and as you've pointed out, and we've talked about on our show, fundamentalism and sexuality in any expression is so twisted. We just don't have healthy perspective of our own sexuality, whether it's same-sex sexuality or opposite-sex sexuality, bisexuality, any of it. We don't have a handle on it because we have suppressed it. We've demonized it. We've made it so ugly and sinful that we can't have a valid discussion about it, much less a healthy expression of it.
And again, I mean, that's just one of many things that are affected by this orthodoxy, dogma, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. that just, it just obliterates families, it obliterates lives. And again, when you see somebody like this, where you find there's been this really long history of abuse, mm-hmm. how far will we go? How many victims do we need to have before we say, all right, you can say religious freedom, you can have a church, whatever you want to call it, but there are still boundaries and there are still laws that have to be followed. And, you know, when it comes to investigation, it should be open season. They should be able to walk into a Scientology church or a Baptist church or a Jehovah's Witness church and do what they need to do.
Right, because they've been allowed to hide behind the status and the titles, and there's a news story about this. I actually watched a couple of the local news stories from the Ohio area. Young men who are devastated one of them happened 10 years ago, and the young man is still in therapy. He said it destroyed his marriage. So people's lives are damaged by this long term, and sometimes irreparably. And he said, I thought this was a holy man. I thought he was a prophet of God. So when he told me to take off my clothes, he said, I didn't think about it. And so there's cognitive dissonance, I guess you would call it, on the young man's part. He was able to separate the man from what he was being asked to do, and then the pastor himself.
I don't understand.
I don't understand it. It's something that has fascinated me for years, and particularly recently as I'm working on my new book. How's that for a plug? I'm working on my next novel.
And in this novel,
there is a man who is in the ministry and struggling with these feelings and how they can be expressed. So there is, and he ends up just compartmentalizing his life where what he believes is different than what he sees himself doing. I know what that's like because so many years of my life, I felt one way, but I believed another way. So I understand that. So in one way, my heart goes out to people like Ernest Angley. I don't condone what he did, the duplicity of his teaching and preaching as opposed to his actions, but I do understand.
I separate the two. It's one thing to have a struggle with who we are compared to what we believe, but it's another thing to molest somebody.
Correct.
And to use that power over them. So I lose that empathy for people like him.
Right.
I've lost that empathy for people who lead conversion therapy leaders who are either straight mm-hmm. or who have gone after some of their clients. I don't have any empathy for that. I have no compassion for
right.
someone like that. Maybe I should, but that to me, that's a step beyond, many steps beyond just struggling to reconcile what we feel with what we believe,
or right.
what we feel is true.
Yeah, and again, I don't condone his actions at all. I simply understand his struggle. I think in my own life, I didn't act out in any way like that. I certainly had the opportunity to do that on several occasions, but I do understand the struggle. And we see it. We've seen it goes all the way back to Jimmy Swagger, where he was caught with the hookers in the motel, Jim Baker. We've seen it over and over that there is this it just seems to create the conflict that cannot be ignored or superseded for long. It's going to come out in some way or another.
And these are just the high profile cases.
Yes. We see.
I mean, we know this happens all the time in churches. I mean, you know, you were a pastor. I was a minister for nearly 25 years. The stories we could tell.
Oh, absolutely.
Of people within our own congregations or people that we encountered along the way. It was pretty messed up. And yet, for many years, right, you and I stayed in the ministry. We stayed in the organization and we didn't put the pieces together. We didn't, you know, it was easy for me to look at the couple that were cheating on each other and think, oh, they just need the Lord. They really need to get into the word and they need prayer and that's going to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And never talk about what was actually happening in their marriage, what they brought into the marriage, if there were psychological issues or just the mere fact that we're human beings and monogamy doesn't necessarily work for everyone.
Yes, but we had no framework for anything like that. There was no theological framework, but I could just imagine myself standing in the pulpit in my church is saying something like that, you know, but that's what we were raised with. It's one man, one woman for life.
Right.
And that doesn't always work. And so the bad ideologies lead to bad behavior and bad outcomes.
Absolutely. Agreed.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about our guest.
I know we haven't been doing this podcast very long, so almost every guest is a first for us. But today we have a first. We are interviewing our first married couple, which is very exciting. Sarah Austin, in her own words, is a former vanilla Christian. I can't wait to explore what that is. And we have Sarah's wife, Becca, who is an ex-Jehovah's Witness. Sarah and Becca have two children. And together they host the Sarah Talk podcast, which they discuss news, which intersects politics, religion, and LGBTQ rights. Have actually taken some time and listened to their podcast they do live podcasts. How brave is that? Live podcasts. They have their own studio, which makes me jealous because I'm sitting in a chair at my desk with a microphone, and they also stream video of their podcast. So I'm very jealous of their technique and their technology.
I got to find out how they edit themselves because I would never do this without editing.
Let me tell you, from the two I've listened to, they don't. They just say it. They just come right out and say it. So we're very glad to have them here. There's so much more about their story and their marriage that I want them to talk about. So we're glad to welcome Sarah and Becca.
Thank you guys so much. Yeah. We're excited to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, we don't edit.
We don't.
We just say what we want to say. And if people don't like it, well, oh well.
Well, you have a disclaimer that comes on at the first of your podcast saying, look, it's going to be explicit. We warned you. Here it is. Listen if you want.
Yep.
When I first started the show, I over-edited.
Oh yeah,
which is a terrible thing that you can do.
Hours long process.
I know somebody who does that.
But we also started with, you know, some leftover parts from a stage sound and lighting company that I did for a while.
And it wasn't live. It was, it was like,
but it wasn't really great quality. Yeah. So I felt like I really had to get in and edit it. And it turns out oftentimes if you just let it roll and what happens.
It's more organic.
It's more organic. It's more natural.
Yeah.
So I've listened to, I got to be a guest on your show. You two are, I was really caught, not off guard, but just listening to your show and now being a part of your group on Facebook. Sarah, you're brilliant. I mean, I love the way your mind works. I love the way you think. I love how you process. I love how you articulate all of the things that you say. Was that a process for you or is that something that just comes natural?
Well, thank you. I'm really not sure.
I think it comes natural.
Yeah.
Like, but the 10 years that we've, well, more than 10 years that we've known each other now, she's always been that way. Always.
Mm.
And it's fun to see it evolve and grow because it wasn't necessarily the stuff we talk about now. In the beginning, it was other stuff, you know, like we worked together. So it was work related things and just the when you see the wheels start turning, it's a really amazing thing to watch. But yeah, I definitely think it's a natural thing for her. And now she's blushing.
I'll take it.
So can you explain to us how you guys got together, what your story is, background?
How far back do you want to start?
we could start at least with the picture of you that you posted on the podcast right before this, where you are sitting in a studio back when
you were working
at a radio station.
Well,
I loved that. I loved it.
So yeah, I worked in conservative talk radio in Illinois for a number of years before I moved to Florida. And I produced the number one morning show in the central Illinois market on News Talk 1340 WSOY AM. And I was a dumb 19, 20 year old kid who was skipping college classes and didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I'd been raised in a very conservative area. So I grew up in a town of 1400 people. It's in Bethany, Illinois. It's in the middle of cornfields. I like to say Bethany, zero stoplights, nine churches, but it's not nine churches anymore because one of them closed down and it's actually for sale right now. If you're interested in owning a church from 1916 with five bed, four baths and a detached sanctuary for $40,000, you could do that.
Wow.
But it was one of those places where everybody went to church, you know? And so that's Trump country, very conservative, rural farming community. And so when I worked in the radio station, it was just kind of another extension of that. Decatur, Illinois is an industry town. We had Caterpillar and Firestone, A.E. Staley. So our talk show was very much conservative. And then we ran, after our morning show, we had G. Gordon Liddy and Dr. Laura Schlesinger and Mike Gallagher.
Oh, my.
The who's who of conservative talk radio, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of an indoctrination into that conservative mindset that I had to break from when I moved to Florida.
Wow. And she said she grew up in rural, and I was so fascinated by the fact that you said you actually lived in a log cabin.
Yeah, my parents built a log cabin. My mother was, the day before she went into labor with me, she was sitting on the wraparound porch nailing in deck boards.
Oh my gosh.
Building a log cabin. And then the next day went into labor.
They built the log cabin.
My dad worked at Caterpillar his whole life, retired from there not too long ago. And he took some years off to try his hand at farming, which was not great. Not real successful at that. So we built a log cabin out in the country. It was, and I loved it. Like,
she's still bitter that they moved out of the house.
It was the best house. But I give a lot of crap to, you know, being rural and growing up in the country and not having LGBTQ organizations or resources or any of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But also, like, when we think about the good old days of the Make America Great Again sort of mindset, it's that slow, simple time of life that I grew up in. So I understand it, at least.
And I assume your family was conservative, church going. What denomination were you involved in?
We went to a First Christian church. We were in church every Sunday. This is the vanilla Christian. We were in church every Sunday and we prayed at, like, you know, the important meals on the holidays, but we didn't talk about it a lot outside of the church. At home, it wasn't really we didn't talk about God. We didn't talk about faith. We didn't study the Bible.
Not a lifestyle, just a thing you did.
It was something that we did, yeah. And then when I moved out on my own, I ended up at a Church of God for a girl, because it's always a girl. And that was culture shock, right? Because the church I grew up in was a be quiet, sit down, listen until it's time to stand up and sing. And the Church of God is a put your hands in the air and shout up, the Spirit moves you kind of place. But
yep.
They had a praise band and I played guitar, and it wasn't long before I was playing guitar in the praise band. And then it wasn't long after that that I started doing a one-on-one Bible study with the youth pastor. And he had me going through, like, chapter by chapter, reading and writing down the truths and the promises. And I don't really remember a lot of specifics, but I just, that was that long progression from I'm a believer to, okay, this is some crazy stuff. Never heard that from the pulpit before. And this, the more I learned, the less I believed.
Mm.
So there wasn't like a moment that changed me that I can look back to and say, that was when I lost my faith. Mm-hmm. It was a long, slow progression over time. I became apathetic for a while first, and then and then I became an activist when I came out as trans and had to deal with all of that.
And was this simultaneous to the faith issues as you began to determine your gender identity? Were you also, was this part of causing you to question your faith?
They were more parallel. Then there wasn't really a lot of intersections. It was during puberty that I noticed, like, hey, something doesn't feel right about this. I don't understand. And not like in the way a quote unquote normal boy would, you know, go into puberty. It's confusing for everybody. But for me, it was, you know, something's not right. I don't feel right on my body.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I not a girl? What would it feel like to be a girl? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great if I could wake up tomorrow morning and just be a girl? And none of that ever really connected with the things that was happening in my faith life. I mean, around the same time, I started a Bible club in my school, did that for a while. That was interesting. And organized a meet me at the pole at our school. So I was, they never really connected. I didn't hear a lot of preaching about, you know, homosexuality is a sin and gender identity. See, this was, you know, in the 90s. And we didn't have the language that we have today. Transgender wasn't a word. Mm-hmm. Gender identity wasn't even a word. We were just joking on the Jerry Springer show.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it, you know, it even crossed that radar at all.
Yeah. And that wasn't just because you lived rural. It was kind of a national thing.
Right. I mean, yeah.
I was watching a movie recently that was made back in the late 80s, early 90s, and they continued to refer to the transsexual. And there was so much confusion, and it was transsexual as opposed to cross-dressing. And so there was a lot of confusion and terminology. And it was, and people who were what we would know as transgender today referred to themselves this way.
Right. Yeah. The language has exponentially increased the ways that we, and the great thing that I like about the community as a whole is that it's all really self-defined. Like it's your mm-hmm. your experience is personal to you, and you can explain that in here's a menu of words that you can choose from that describes how you are.
Were you then, I don't know if we want to say leaving the church or rethinking the church at the same time as you were coming out trans, or was that a separate process? Did you leave first, come out trans later, or how did that work?
I had stopped going to this church. That was the last, the Church of God was the last church I had gone to regularly. And then it was after that, I was kind of in an apathetic state when it came to belief and faith. It's not something that I ever really thought about, that I really started dealing with the trans issues. You know, I had explored femininity as a, you know, teenager in the only way that I knew how, which is, you know, you go to your mom and your sisters and borrow clothes, right? And, yeah. Get caught many, many times. And, you know, so moving out on my own, then I was able to really kind of explore, but still only privately. And so I, at that point I wasn't going to church. So there was no chance that there could have been that influence anyway. So, I explored that for 20 years before I ever really like sat down and said, okay, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. This is what I need to do about it.
I was very fascinated with a statement you made in your bio on your webpage, where you talk about being of the generation on the front edge of the internet.
Yeah.
And we think today kids have so much access to so much information, but you were talking about your first experience, your first connection was an external 12 baud modem,
yeah,
and Prodigy. And you had to, and it was a long distance call to connect, but that way you found bulletin boards. And I remember that was my first connection as well. I'm older than you, but finding bulletin boards and being able to connect with other people and have these conversations.
Yeah, it was great. Other than my mother would set an egg timer, she would twist up an egg timer, right, and set it on top of the computer desk, and that's how much time I had to be online.
That's awesome.
But it really was. It opened up a whole new world of people that like that feeling of being alone in the world and a freak, and nobody else feels like me, and I am so strange. There must be something wrong with me. And then the internet happened, and oh my gosh, there are other people out there who are like me. Mm-hmm. This isn't just a something wrong with me thing. There's other people like me, and that's cool.
Yeah. Now, Becca, you grew up a Jehovah's Witness?
I did.
Oh.
Yeah. I was about 8 years old when my parents started going to Kingdom Hall, so I wasn't born into it, but my memories of pre-Jehovah's Witness life were, we had a very close family relationship with both sides of my family. My dad was real close to his parents and his brothers, and my mom likewise with her family, and it was weird. There was a little bit of time there when they first started going to the Kingdom Hall where it was like complete cutoff. We didn't associate with family at all. And I remember my grandmother used to tell the story of how she actually went so long without hearing from my dad that she called the Kingdom Hall to find out why he wasn't coming to see her. She says it was months before he finally like came to see, but it was like they just jumped in, you know, head first. And basically overnight it was like, okay, we're not going to celebrate birthdays, we're not going to celebrate holidays. And you know, I remember going into summer school and bragging about it and being all excited. Oh, now I'm a Jehovah's Witness. And it was an exciting thing. In that very mind of an 8-year-old, it's something different, I guess. I don't know.
I've heard a lot of stories from other people who went into Jehovah's Witness at 6, 7, 8 years old, 5 years old. And they were saying that it was very traumatic because suddenly they weren't getting birthday presents. They weren't getting Christmas presents. They were asked to sit outside the classrooms when these other parties were going on.
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
A little bit of like both, I guess. Looking back on it, it makes me a little bitter. While it was happening, I don't know necessarily that I felt like I missed out on anything. My parents were really good about, well, we don't celebrate Christmas, but we're going to have a family celebration. We did a celebration of their anniversary every year, and we did presents for everybody. And then after Christmas, the tax refund was like, oh, now we're going to go buy some, like we got a new game system or a new thing for, you know, we did a lot of family trips. We did have a lot to supplement the stuff that we were missing out on. So I don't feel like while it was happening, I was feeling much dismay over it. After the fact, like as an adult now, not having those memories of Christmas and those memories of birthdays that everybody else that I know has, I find myself trying to navigate the waters of how do I create those memories for my kids when I don't have anything to kind of base that off of. So I think that's where I struggle the most with it. Being bitter about it in hindsight, I don't have anything to compare it to. So I feel like a lot of times Sarah might get annoyed with me because I go way overboard for birthdays and Christmas.
All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back with some more questions.
I'm Gail Jordan, Executive Director of Recovering from Religion. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Recovering from Religion is an online community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. We're not here to talk you out of or into faith. We just provide a safe place to examine what you believe and perhaps why you believe it. We have staff who can take your calls and chats, and we can help connect you with an evidence-based therapist in your area. On our website, you'll find an extensive database of resources, as well as where to find local support groups in many communities. We want to help you resolve issues around your faith. Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the Volunteer tab. Also, we invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. All contributions go directly to fund Recovering from Religion programs and outreach efforts. On our website, click on the donate button for instruction.
Now, Becca, you were talking about going into Jehovah's Witness at a young age. At what point did you, was it your family that left, or did you ultimately make the decision to begin to reexamine all of that?
I kind of like, I like to say I grew out of it. My dad was an elder in the congregation, and I was very goody two shoes about it for a very long time. I became a full-time pioneer. I put in 90 hours of field service, door-to-door work a month. I went to the special like pioneer school they only send you to if you've, you know, completed this for a year, you have to do it. And I took it very seriously. And I think sometimes I took it too seriously. My family was actually very wishy-washy at times. Like, witnesses don't celebrate holidays, yet every year we would go to my aunt's house. My mom insisted we went to my aunt's house during Thanksgiving, because she had this annual thing and the whole family came in, and I felt conflicted, because it was like, well, we're not supposed to celebrate Thanksgiving, but we go to Thanksgiving dinner and we sit through the Thanksgiving prayer. And, you know, we were always told, well, just say your own prayer in your head. And we're just there to see the family, but we were still partaking in the festival of the, you know, like, we were there. And I always wondered what the impression that the family got from that was, because on the other hand of it, we were always told you have to set an example as one of Jehovah's servants, and anything you do is going to reflect on him, negative or positive. So I always felt very conflicted with things like that. I remember specifically probably the worst thing that one of my bigger regrets was, I insisted that I wasn't going to go to my Nana's 90th birthday party. Even though my whole family my mom, dad, and brother who were witnesses went. I put my foot down and I said, nope, I'm not going. I've got to work that day. And I didn't take the day off of work, and I stayed, and they left town and they went to her party, and she died shortly after that. But it was one of those things where the entire family was there, and I just was so tired of the hypocrisy and the flip-flopping of, well, we're going to nitpick which activities we're going to be included in, but still hold up this thing that we're Jehovah's Witnesses. And it was kind of at that point where I regretted it so much that I decided I was going to start really analyzing, like, if this is the truth, why is it so hard for so many people to actually practice what they preach? Because it wasn't just my family that seemed to have these double standards. I was seeing it a lot in the congregation. By this point, I was an adult. I was still living at home, but I was over the age of 18. And I had switched congregations. I wasn't in the same congregation as my parents. I was working full time. At some point in there, I was working three jobs. So it was very easy for me to kind of just check out, go to work, ignore everything that was going on inside of my head. Like, because you go to the meetings and you sit there and you listen to these sermons and you're reading your Bible and you're hearing the way that they twist the scriptures to make it mean what they want it to mean. And so I just started gradually skipping meetings and using work as an excuse. And it got to the point where I just didn't want to go back. There were things that were happening. I was getting really sick a lot. I had been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which years later, we found out it should have been juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, but I was having lots of chronic pain. And I would not go to the meetings, and I would miss my field service time. I wasn't making my hours. And the elders would tell me, oh, just keep praying about it. Just keep praying about it. Jehovah will take care of you. And well, Jehovah didn't take care of it. It just kept getting worse. So I just kind of checked out and thought, you know what? I can't do this right now. And I don't know that I ever left. There was one moment when I left and I thought, I'm not going to deal with them anymore because of how insensitive they were to the physical problems I was having. I was trying to tell them I can't put in the 90 hours anymore. You have to take me off of the list. And they basically told me, nope, we're not going to take you off the list. Pray to Jehovah about it. He'll understand. He'll take care of you. If we take you off the list, you're going to lose his blessings. And at that point, I already felt like I'd lost his blessings because he wasn't answering my prayers. So I remember that was like the only time I really walked out and felt like I didn't want to go back. But I think at the time I thought more like, I don't want to go back to that congregation. Now, this was the second congregation I've ever been in. So I thought, well, if I go back, I'll just go somewhere else. But I knew that I needed to take a break. And been suffering from depression and got down to the very bottom. Like, I think the lowest I've ever been. I was extremely close, like, to just trying to end it all kind of moment. And a friend called and said, hey, I need a roommate. I'm in Orlando. And so I packed up. 2 weeks went by and I just packed everything into my car and I left and started over. And I haven't been to a Kingdom Hall since.
I think that many people have that kind of experience where, as you said, you didn't make a definitive decision, but a few decisions little by little
right.
give you the freedom and the space mm-hmm. to rethink a lot more of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was definitely one of those things where, it was years past.
Oh, yeah.
And I think when I was pregnant with our son, he's 9, or going to be 9 this year. When I was pregnant with him and I was on maternity leave, just waiting, that's when I discovered the whole YouTube community of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's when I really started to go, whoa, what the heck was I involved in? Because my family was still witnesses. And it was really weird for me because I moved in with my then boyfriend and I wasn't married and we were living together. And then I was pregnant and I never got disfellowshipped from the congregation, but they were still talking to me, which was weird for me because I had so many friends that left and had the opposite experience. And so I just chalked that up to my family has always been wishy-washy. But it's just funny because of those experiences, it made me do more research. Like, what are they teaching now? How have the doctrines changed? Because that was another thing leading up to right when I left. A lot of doctrinal changes had been made. Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, there's always like a group of people that just kind of fall away because they've changed the doctrine that they've held so strong to. And now, oh, wait, by the way, we didn't mean that. We mean this now. So that kind of all happened right in the same time where I was just having a week go of it anyway. And so I think a lot of people probably thought it had something to do with that, but I think it was more just what was going on in my own personal life. But then when you go back and you do the research and you find out, I was like, man, I'm so glad I wasn't hook, line, and sinker at that time. Cause I really would have looked like a crazy person going back and cause it just didn't make sense to me. The change.
Yeah. In church, they call it theological shifting. As a fiction writer, we call it a plot twist.
The witnesses call it, they have a scripture. It says the light gets brighter. So new light is what they call
new
it.
Light. In the witnesses. New light. Yeah. I used to hear a lot of that when I was working. I used to work with a lot of charismatics and somebody would come up with something and I'd look at them and I have a theological education. I'd look at them and go, what? They say, oh, this is new light, or this is new wave, or third wave, or sixth wave, and I'd go, what?
That's because, Bill, you didn't have the full gospel like us Pentecostals.
Well, I know. I have baptism in the Holy Ghost. I was Baptist. We didn't have that. So,
hey, Becca, I have a question. It's interesting to me that you call your family wishy-washy instead of what I've heard from other Jehovah's Witnesses is how strict their families were, and they would have loved to have had a family that was still involved in their own family activities. But for you, in your mind, you saw that differently. Why was that?
I was so indoctrinated. I really felt that by going to Thanksgiving dinner, we were doing something wrong. We were bringing reproach on Jehovah. We were going to die at Armageddon because we weren't obeying him. That's how I felt.
But where does that come from? It didn't come from your family.
No, it didn't come from my family. But it came directly from the teachings of the organization. I was one of those kids who I studied and I studied hard. And if I was going to do something, I did it the right way. That's why I say I was goody two shoes about it. I had to be the teacher's pet. I had to have an answer for every Bible study where you raise your hand and you have an answer. I studied the Watchtower magazine next to my Bible. I wrote my answers out. I highlighted everything. I gave talks at, I think I was like 10 years old, and I would get up on the stage and give a discussion talk with another sister where I was doing the lesson. I just took it very seriously. And it scared me a lot of the times because my mom was my mom was a witness before she ever met my dad. We're going to go way back. She was raised in the Catholic Church and she converted to Jehovah's Witness and married a guy. And then they got divorced and she met my dad. And when she met my dad, she left the Jehovah's Witnesses and was disfellowshipped. And she was out for 10 years before she finally came back. And the reason they came back was because my dad had been involved in some bad things. He was going to jail a lot for various illegal things. And she basically said, you straighten up your act, you start studying the Bible, or you're going to lose your family because I'm going to take your children away and you're never going to see them again.
Hmm.
And so he decided, like, there was a little Jehovah's Witness man that lived in our neighborhood and he would come to our door every Saturday morning and ask my dad for Bible study. And he did it like from the time that we moved into that house when I was a baby until finally this thing happened where he had, my mom had given him all the chances she was going to give him. And he said, okay, I'm going to do it. And that's how we became witnesses again. Like that's how she came back into it. But she was always very close to her family. And I think that that is the sole reason that she was so wishy-washy because she didn't want to lose her family over the religion.
Well, and it's interesting. One of the stories that we've talked about on our show is I can remember we worked at Disney, at Walt Disney World together. Did. We met in Fantasyland.
The Magic Kingdom.
Oh, I want to write about that.
Everybody listening just vomited.
I want to write a romantic comedy about that.
But I remember when Becca moved in. And I remember when Becca got pregnant. And I remember the stress that she carried of I'm going to have to call my mom and have this conversation that, of course, this was all pre-transition for me. So she's going to have to call mom and say, I'm living with a guy. The guy got me pregnant. And in the teachings of the church, that's grounds to turn your back and shun.
Yeah.
Like that. She just didn't know how her mother was going to react, but well, in true your mother fashion.
Right. And I don't, I even say all the time, like anytime we talk about this, I don't know why I was so afraid that they were going to turn their back on me, but it was just something that was so ingrained in my head because that is what you do. But I knew my family and my aunt, I love her to death. One of my mom's sisters, I actually went to her house. She's the one we go to Thanksgiving dinner for every year. I went to her house on a trip and was telling her, and this was actually before I ever moved out of the house. But I knew, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I know that I don't want to go back. I know that but I can't, like, I'm afraid to tell them. And my mom said, you know what? Your mom left the Catholic Church and turned her back on the church to go do this crazy thing. And not one of her family members has turned their back on her. So if she turns her back on you, you have a whole family behind you. And that kind of was the only thing in the back of my mind that I kept coming back to. Like, it will be my parents that I lose. But I still have like four aunts and uncles and all of my cousins. And I still have a huge family that will take care of me if I need them. And so that kind of gave me a little bit of like backbone to stand up and say, okay, mom, hey. But again, it was all for nothing because she was so excited. She's like, oh, really? Like, okay.
I have so many questions for you, Becca.
Okay.
just one small observation is I'm really curious to see if the reason that Jehovah's Witness worked for you was because it was a sense of security. If your dad was getting arrested and now he's not getting arrested, now you see things starting to, you know, kind of go into place. And then I could see where it's more difficult for you to leave because it's pulled your family together. It's kept things cohesive in a chaotic environment. Then what was that process like when you're working, you're coming to terms with maybe this isn't true? That had to be just frightening for you.
You know, it's one of those things that because it didn't all happen at once, I think was the reason that it was so easy for me. A lot of things happened in between me moving out and me really realizing that, oh my God, this is a crazy cult. So the moving out thing, like my mom and my dad, they're now divorced. They've been divorced for about 5 years, ish. They've been separated probably longer than that. When I moved out, it was a very big tension between my parents because I was daddy's girl. And my dad knew that the biggest reason that I had to move out was because of the conflict that I had with my mom. Now, my dad can do no wrong in my eyes. There's only been like one time where I really got really pissed off at him because he was just that, it was that bad. But I'm daddy's girl and my mom and I always fight like over everything. And we always have. And I always felt like she was just jealous of the relationship that I had with my dad. Her dad died when she was little. She was like four, I think. So she never had that. So she could never really understand it. And he always had my back. He always defended me. Anytime my mom and I were going at it, he almost always sided with me. And we could not live in the same house. So it was really, really rough. And I think a lot of teenagers have those growing pains with their parents. But for me, it was to an extreme because on top of that normal thing, I could see the hypocrisy in my mom and I hated it because I was like, you brought me into this. You teach me this and you want me to act this certain way, but you don't even act this way. And I wasn't afraid to say that. And that just made it even worse because, you know, when your kid calls you out for being a hypocrite, it's not a pleasant thing. So my dad, I think to this day, blames my mom for me moving out. He left. Eventually, he got disfellowshipped and left the organization. And my brother is out. But now my brother's living with my mom, who's still in. So that's awkward.
your mom still is a witness?
She is still a witness. And it's weird to me because there's, you know, when you've known somebody for so long and you know their stories and what they do and what they've done. And I just don't understand it. She's a super intelligent woman. She has an amazing job. She works for an amazing company. And the job that she does, it just astonishes me that she can be that intelligent to do that job, but she cannot figure out that she's in a cult.
And she is okay with you. You said you were worried when you were living together and then when you were pregnant. How is she with the relationship now?
Will
Sarah, do you want to take this?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
We got into it, her mother and I, one night. We were out in the backyard. We had the fire pit going. This
was before or after transition?
This was before transition.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was, she was offended by my outspokenness, my outspoken atheist. And how dare I not respect her and her beliefs? And I remember that conversation very vividly. She had had a few drinks and
the persecution complex is very strong, like extreme with my mother. Like you could say something about like, I don't know,
anything.
It could be like the butter. Color of her shirt. It most people wouldn't know if you were talking positive or negative. Oh, that's an interesting shade of jade. She would take it as a personal attack.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. So, if you've listened to some of my stuff, I try as best as I can to attack the bad ideas and not the people. And, right. And that's all it's ever been with her is like, look, I just think that this stuff you believe is pretty crazy. And that's not, I'm not saying anything about you. So there's that component of it where she feels like where I disrespect her beliefs. And then I transitioned.
Oh, yeah. So that was an awkward conversation. Oh, by the way, mom. So my husband is going to become my wife and I'm okay with that. What? How can you be okay with that? Like...
And I'm sure that's not the first awkward conversation you've had with people on that subject.
No, but it was probably the least accepting.
Yeah,
like we haven't run into much. Like we've been really fortunate with our family. Like there's been a few like awkward like, but she like immediately out the gate was just like, I don't understand. I can't understand. I don't understand how you're going to stay with him. I don't get this at all. I was pregnant with our daughter and she came up to help me. We were getting furniture for the nursery and we were driving around town like to go look at furniture And we drove past these townhomes that they were building. She's like, oh, I should get a townhome in there. I want to live close to my grandbabies. I should get a 3-bedroom townhome so that when your marriage falls apart, you can move in with me.
Wow.
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 Like, just very vocally, adamantly, totally against. And it's funny because now her story is that she's been the most supportive.
Yet she still says he and my name. Old name. Oh, right.
Yeah. Like, wow. It's insane. Yeah. And when you correct her, like I'll say she, or I'll say Sarah. Oh, well, you know what I mean. Okay. It's been like almost 4 years. Uh-huh. Yeah. So you need to get over it.
But Becca was the most supportive person. Mm-hmm. Like, I would never have been able to be where I am now in this journey had it not been for what our relationship has grown and become.
Sure.
So I went to a therapist for one visit. I don't know what I had in my mind, but I sat down with her and we talked it out. And I said, look, this is how I feel. This is what's going on. This is how long it's been happening, all of the things. And she said, classic gender dysphoria. When do you want to start? Like, literally, it was, yep, you are textbook. Mm-hmm. So you want to transition? When do you want to start? And I was like, oh, shit, yes, let's do this. Finally. Mm-hmm. Well, then I had to come home and have a conversation with Becca. And I don't know that I anticipated any reluctance on your part, but we ended up back in therapy together just to have a conversation, the two of us, to talk about how this is going to affect things.
Right.
And she had a couple of very valid questions that needed to be
addressed.
Right.
And, you know, once I think, correct me if I'm wrong. Once she learned that, or realized, not learned, once she realized that you didn't fall in love with a person's parts, right? I didn't fall in love with your penis. I fell in love with you, the person.
Right.
And who you, the person, are doesn't change when you go through the transition. Like, there are emotional changes and physical changes. And yes, it will be different. But the core of who that person is still going to be there. Hmm. And if you can get to that, you guys are golden. And we have been.
Which is fascinating, because I don't know many stories like yours.
Right.
I know trans people, but I don't know many stories like yours.
It was very scary for me, because that was my biggest fear was, she's going to go through this. She's going to transition. It's going to tear us apart, because it's going to be too much. Because every story that I saw was the wife was, or the husband was, super supportive in the beginning. But then once the change happened, and once all the pieces started falling where they lay, then that's when things started falling apart in the relationship. So I was terrified that was going to be the case. But at the same time, I had to accept that this person that I love is never going to be whole and complete. And I would not be able to live with myself if I was the reason. Because she said to me, she came home and she said, this is what I need to do. But if it's going to make you leave me, then I'm not going to do it. I want to stay with you. And so she was willing to make that sacrifice. And so I got to that point where I had to make that sacrifice, because that was the right thing to do. And knowing, even if our marriage falls apart, we would still be friends. We had a son who we both adore. We needed it to be okay for him. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want him to have one parent who just wasn't complete, even if that meant that our marriage would end. Luckily it didn't, but that's where I was. I had to make that sacrifice and hope that we could get through it. And we did.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Sarah, but I'm tearing up back here.
Me too.
I heard that, Becca. But it is, because I mean, that's what love is. It's mm-hmm. it's about the other person and wanting the other person to be who they are, and it's such a fortunate but unusual, a rare thing to find that kind of person in your life. And I'm going to stop now, because I'm going to lose it. Tim, go ahead.
Well, I'm curious to know, for both of you, clearly deeply emotional pain that you both went through. Sarah, I've heard stories of others that have had a transition, and now you've created this life for yourself. You have a wife, you've got children. What were you feeling when you, I'm sure there was a point of elation where you say, yes, it's been identified. This is exactly what it is. And I can see a path to wholeness. Mm-hmm. And yet I've got a family. What do I do with that? How were you feeling and what was that like?
Yeah, definitely. There is a cognitive dissonance of the gender euphoria, right? When I finally realized my full self and look at myself in the mirror and go, yeah, okay, I'm okay with who I am now. But I have a son who goes to school with other kids in a very conservative red county. And what are those kids learning from their parents? Mm-hmm. And is our school going to be supportive? When I go to, we have a space night every year. When I go to space night, is there going to be a problem with me using restrooms at the school? Mm-hmm. All of those things just swirl into play of, you know, in addition to my father's biggest concern when I came out was, well, I don't know how you're going to keep a job. I had a pretty decent job. doing okay for myself, but I worried about that too, right? My HR department had never dealt with anything like this before. So I was kind of teaching them. I didn't know how my coworkers or, anybody was going to respond to it. It's so much unknown that's, it's scary. I haven't had any issues, luckily.
Yeah.
And then your wife, what was it like to go to what did you experience when you had to say to Becca, this is what was said. This was a recommendation.
I think I was in that elated state when that conversation happened because I don't remember anticipating any resistance at all. I was just like, yes, I'm in a good place. Like, I'm finally
there. I think like I already like knew kind of like what to expect. I knew trans kids from back. I mean, I grew up in South Florida. I spent my weekends at Fort Lauderdale Beach. I knew trans people. I worked at Macy's in the visual display department. I knew gay people. I knew a lot of people in the LGBT community. So it wasn't anything that surprised me. I wasn't shocked by it because I knew about how it was presented to me originally was I cross-dress. So I knew about that and I knew it was something that made her feel good. And so in the back of my mind, I kind of felt like this is the path that we're going to eventually have to decide whether or not we're going down. Now, I don't know necessarily that I was prepared for it emotionally when it happened, because it did take like a couple of visits to the therapist for me to really be okay and understand that, okay, this is what's going to happen and this is the consequences of that and like lay it all out. I always said Sarah had 30 plus years in this mind prepare for that.
Right.
I had none of that. I had way less considerably to be emotionally prepared for whatever happened. So I think when she came home and said that, I already kind of knew, but my only thing was I wanted another baby.
You were quiet. Mm-hmm. You were quiet.
I was quiet.
About a day.
I stewed in it. Stewed in it. And I wasn't angry. I was emotional because I was like, at that point in our lives, there was no way. We already knew there was no way. We couldn't afford another baby. So I think that's why I was so quiet, because I was like, I know we cannot afford another baby. But then I talked to a friend of mine and I said, listen, this is what's going on. This is what the therapist has said. This is what I'm staring at, but I want my son to have a sibling and we can't afford that. And you know what my friend said to me? And it was the funniest thing because I bust out laughing. I'm like, you know what? You're right. This is so stupid. She said, if you can't afford another baby, he can't afford to transition. Mm-hmm. So just put it out there and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so I did. And we had another baby.
Right. And I was like,
that was it.
I was like, oh, that was all the last 24 hours of silence? That's it. Sure. Let's have another baby.
Like, I know once you start on those hormones,
the factory closes.
It's done. And people will say, oh, yeah, but you can back off of the drugs. But I'm very, as somebody who has lots of medical conditions, it concerned me to think, well, let's try to conceive a baby later and back off the drugs, because you don't know what that does to your product.
Right.
Yeah. Really.
You have no idea. So
I mentioned at the beginning of the show about testosterone. I'm doing cancer treatments. Yeah. And the treatments they're giving me are hormone suppression. So I understand the let's stop, because we've stopped and started once before, and it's traumatic.
Yeah, it is some powerful stuff, the testosterone pumping through.
I don't think I realized that.
And then not pumping through.
Yeah, right, and when you switch it off, it's completely different.
It really is.
Yeah, I definitely think there was more emotions on my part for that than there were for Sarah's, just because of like knowing like, okay, this is the end of something, the beginning of something else, but also the end. And so once we close that door, I want to make sure that I don't ever want to reopen it.
So explain what you're doing now. You're working together. You have this podcast. How did that develop, and what are your goals right now?
Well, I started the podcast in 2015 as just a way to tell that transition story. And we did that. But then North Carolina passed House Bill 2. And we were talking about some news stories that were LGBT focused. But then House Bill 2 happened. Texas had Senate Bill 6 not long after that. And we felt the rush of the religious right coming at the community. Mm-hmm. And then the whole election thing happened where Donald Trump became this popular candidate and won. And so the show shifted into a much more political activist-y. I found myself stumbling on more news stories that shined that spotlight on, look, and whenever there's someone coming after my community, they are either wearing a MAGA hat, carrying a Bible, or more often both. And so that's kind of encapsulates, I think, what a lot of the things that we talk about. That's kind of what it's come down to.
And if you were to tell somebody, just kind of in a sentence or two, what your podcast is about, and also so we can, before we close this out, where can they find your podcast?
Yeah, so I describe it as we talk about all the things that you're not supposed to talk about at work. Even though I do talk about it at work with some certain people, you got to know your audience, right? You got
to
know
your audience. Definitely not safe to listen to at work.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
Yes, I would definitely concur with that.
And so we're doing some other things here too. Having come from a rural area, I have a passion for community in rural areas, and so growing up without those connections. So we have created an atheist group for Polk County, where we live. It is just getting off the ground, but we're working to get affiliated with American Atheists, and we'll probably look at the American Humanist Association and Freedom from Religion Foundation and others. But we're getting that off the ground, and I want to build that into something that does activist-y things. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a social meetup hangout group. Like we need to be engaged in the community and doing community service projects and all of that kind of stuff. And none of that exists in this county. We would have to, you know, it's either go to Orlando, which is an hour drive, or go to Tampa, which is an hour more. So I really wanted to build that here. So that's something that Becca and I have been personally working on building up in addition to the podcast. So that's a Facebook group, Polk County Atheists. If there's anybody listening from Polk County, we'd love to see you. And then podcast is at saratalk.com, and that's Sarah with an H. It's on Apple Podcasts, Google Play,
anywhere you get your podcasts,
Spreaker, Stitcher, all the major pod players. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Or if anybody wants to reach out directly, we'd love to hear from you. Yeah. Our email is producer@saratalk.com.
And I have to say again, Sarah and Becca, being able to be on your podcast, being a part of the Facebook group is so enlightening, and it's encouraging and it's funny. You guys are amazing. I love your story. I appreciate you sharing your story with us, and I love what you're doing. And I hope people are able to follow that. Again, just look it up, Sarah Talk, and check out the podcast. We want to thank you both for being on the show today. It's been just a privilege and an honor to talk with you and to hear your story. And I love what you guys are doing. So I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering From Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.